It's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek, brought to you by the Rock Creek Free Press.
Welcome to another edition of the New American Dream radio show. Tonight, I want to talk about the great ID card conspiracy. What do I mean by that, you ask? Well, listen. I'll tell you about my recent dealings with banks and government bureaucracy. It hasn't been a lot of fun. It all started when Bank of America sent me a letter telling me they were eliminating free checking accounts like the one they talked me into a couple years back. They announced that they'd be charging $12 a month. Considering I only have the account so I have a place to cash the occasional check, and the balance is usually in cents, not dollars, I wasn't very happy. Needless to say, I started looking for a new bank. Now, it seems most banks are not offering free checking anymore. Who knew? I've never paid for a bank account. I don't intend to start now. So I studied, and I found one that sounded okay. They did require that we get my wife's SSI check deposited in order for it to be free. We went to the bank. It turned out they're ceasing operations in Florida. Well, that wasn't so good. We checked another one across the street, tried a couple others, were riding our bike around the neighborhood. Finally found a nice small one, and that's when the next challenge came along. It seems my wife's ID expired in 2009. Now, you have to wonder about that. How can an ID card expire? I mean, I can more or less understand the concept of a driver's license expiring. And if they think driving is such a privilege and all that, I don't really buy into it, but, well, I don't drive anymore because I got caught driving under suspension too many times. I try to stay out of jail, prefer it. Anyway, how can an ID card expire? Does your name run out after a certain time? You have to renew it? I don't understand it at all. It just doesn't seem right. But Lorraine's ID was expired. No matter what the nice lady at the bank tried to do, the card would not serve to properly identify her to open her bank account. So I figured, no problem, right? Head over to DMV, get a new one. I knew the price had gone up from $3 to $25. I had no idea how difficult they'd made it to get a new ID. Homeland Insecurity has arrived right here in the Paris of America, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. After riding our bikes 2 miles to the infamous District of Motor Vehicles office, waiting a while, actually not that long, I have to be fair about that, we ended up getting turned away. Now, we had the two pieces of mail to prove where we lived. She had the birth certificate her mom had mailed her a while back. She had her Social Security card, not to mention the old ID that had her picture. That was supposed to be all we need, but oh no. One of the envelopes had my name on it, so they wanted a copy of our marriage certificate. And her birth certificate wasn't a certified copy. No cigar, folks. Try again another time. I got so mad and loud, the trooper almost decided to lock me up that day, but he decided to let me leave the premises. I told him I didn't plan to come back when my wife tries again. He seemed to be relieved by that. You know, I'm only about 120 pounds soaking wet. I'm a pacifist, but for some reason people run the other way when I get mad. Something about my eyes or I don't know. Anyway, now we're waiting to get this certified copy of Lorraine's birth certificate. Had to send $15. And we'll make sure she has two pieces of mail with her name on them. And then we'll have to save up to $25 again so she can ride back over to DMV and give it another try. And if all that works, finally, she can get on the bank account. And then her check can be deposited there, and we won't have to pay the fee for the account. This whole thing reminds me of that horseshoe nail poem they used to read to us when we were little. I knew this kingdom was lost, but I didn't realize that little people like my wife and me actually ran into the real effects of it. It's depressing to know that the erosion of this country has proceeded to such a low level. But we still don't have the guts for a revolution, do we? The lie that Mike often talks about, the lie that is America, that lie has come home to all of us, and I don't like it. And now my co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Well, hello, Chuck. I guess I was going to complain about my week, but I think I'll be quiet now. I went to a Twins ball game this morning, driving from Duluth. It was snowing when I left here, and the score was 15-3, but when I got home, it was about 60 degrees. Well, tonight we would like to welcome Anthony Racine from Chicago and Bob Truskowski. He's from Texas, somewhere in Texas. And Bob is a Bigfoot researcher. The New American Dream, what's this all about? I think it's about becoming the sort of country we always thought we were. And I mentioned Bigfoot with Bob. And Bigfoot is actually a big part of the New American Dream, believe it or not. And I can see Chuck rolling his eyes right now. But let me explain. You know, we always talk about that things should be open for discussion. Everything should be able to be talked about at an American Thanksgiving dinner. And if anybody around that table has the curiosity and temerity to mention Bigfoot, he's immediately sent to Siberia by Aunt Enid with a roll of her eyes, never to be heard from again. And the same thing is with 9/11 in Waco, Oklahoma City, Wellstone, JFK, RFK, the moon landings. If you're on the so-called anti-American side of the discussion. But really, Aunt Edith and Uncle Fester, they should allow open discussion. They probably would learn something, and this country would not suck quite so much. Long before I believed in Bigfoot, I believed in the United States. I always trusted the U.S. I believed totally in the United States of America. And back in, I think it was the early 80s, I managed to drag myself across the line at Offutt Air Force Base and get arrested. It was hard to do. And we are always, we are brought up to obey the law. And to put oneself on the other side against all that, it's just really hard. It was, you know, I don't know. I was sitting on the lawn. After you cross the line, you're arrested. And I think we had plastic handcuffs. It was a long time ago. But I sat on the lawn and I was crying. And it was raining. I remember that. And it was just a tough thing. I also remember later after I had been sentenced and went to prison, I remember where I was being transferred to Leavenworth from a Chicago prison and then from Chicago to Terre Haute. And then it was going to be an overnight at Leavenworth. And it was a prison bus. You're handcuffed. And I can't remember if we were shackled at the ankles or not. But anyway, we're coming up. It was raining. And the lightning, every time the lightning would flash, you could see the big wall of Leavenworth. And let me tell you, you know, when you see that you're coming in a prison bus and you, good old you, who you think so much of, is going to go into Leavenworth, well, it kind of shocks you. And I remember thinking that the only reason that it's so large is to scare you. It does scare you. People who study the different so-called conspiracy theories, the assassinations, the moon landings, UFOs, and Bigfoot, they continuously come in contact with people who just refuse to believe that the U.S. could possibly do these things or could lie or could misrepresent things, or that there's anything about the world that is just totally new or different than what we think it is. And I can see that. If I had not had the different experiences I've had, such as seeing a UFO and various experiences walking in the woods that are deeply mysterious, going to prison, or been exposed to the courageous work done over decades by heroes researching the truth about American history, I really doubt that I would have come up with any of these ideas on my own. And back to that Air Force base and sitting on the lawn crying, it was like I was breaking up with America and it didn't feel great. But once you go through that, either that or something else, maybe you come face to face with a cop or a judge or spend some time in county jail or a prison, you discover that America is false. It does not exist. There is no America, not the one we thought was there. It's much different. And I would say at this date, it's almost evil. It's not the certain most individuals you'll ever meet, but on the power level, where the rubber hits the road, as they say, it's mean, it's not nice. It's not America the beautiful, but it's actually America the perpetrator. And those who run the country are increasingly becoming more and more arrogant. They don't try so much to mask it anymore. They just put it in our face and count on us being afraid. And the important thing is, we cannot be afraid.
The parkland of Washington, D.C., until it meets the mighty Potomac River in the heart of the federal city. On the other hand, Rock Creek Free Press is a fiercely independent newspaper that's not afraid to print the truth. We print the stories that others won't touch. The 9/11 cover-up, media propaganda, government corruption, state terrorism, and violations of our constitutional rights. The Creek is a completely reader-supported publication. We accept no corporate advertising, no corporate influence. For a free, no-obligation issue of The Creek, just go to rockcreekfreepress.com. If you want copies for your local 9/11 Truth Group, send your request to editor@rockcreekfreepress.com. Rock Creek Free Press, not afraid to print the truth.
And now, back to the show with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
Normally, at this point, we bring you news briefs, but this time, we have something special. I'm going to read an excerpt from a letter written by Julius Awafong of Cameroon. Julius is part of the worldwide vote-sizing project that's working for more equitable elections based on a weighted voting concept that's intended to separate money from power. But that's not what his letter is about today. This is an open letter to President Obama, and Julius says it very well. We'll be putting a recording of Julius reading the entire letter on the website, as well as the full text. But tonight, I'm going to share part of it, most of it, with you, our listeners. A letter to President Barack Hussein Obama, 44th President of the USA. Dear Mr. President, November 4th, 2008, most Africans, especially blacks, woke up from bed in excitement and tension. Why? They were anxious to see a black man becoming the boss of the White House in the USA for the first time in history. In beer parlors, street corners, market squares, taxis, buses, schools, and offices, everyone had one name on their lips, Barack Hussein Obama. I downloaded most of your campaign speeches. The one that really carried most of us away was the November 3rd campaign trail speech in Virginia. After listening to the speech, my friend, a veteran journalist referring to you, said, "This guy's voice sounds like that of an angel. People like him appear only once in 50 years. It'll take half a century to get someone like him again, someone that can move the world with hope." Many people who learned that I had your biography and campaign speeches on video came begging one after another to know more about you. On the 4th and 5th night of November, most of us in my neighborhood didn't sleep. We decided to meditate and call on God to do us good by pushing all Americans to cast their votes for you, Mr. President. I stood up the whole night watching the TV, but 30 minutes before the results were declared, I fell into a nap because of fatigue. I woke up to a great shouting as if Cameroon had won the Football World Cup. I jumped up, turned my eyes to the TV, and discovered you had won the presidential election in the USA. It was 4 a.m., a risky time to stroll at night, but even the men of the underworld forgot about their illicit jobs and were in jubilation for your victory. Peter Asoka, a veteran journalist in Cameroon, said in one of his radio reflections, "It's actually not dawned on me yet that a black man, or what do you call it, African-American, colored, etc., is going to take residence at the White House. You must be joking, right? You know, it's like drama, what Shakespeare described as a comedy of errors, the most shocking joke of the 21st century. Mr. President, black men were proud to be black. Mr. President, Africans in their majority thought Africa would be saved from the exploitation and manipulation of their former colonial masters, who had a long-standing tradition of dictating and imposing their own leaders on most African nations. The name Obama is first and foremost an African name, a family name in Cameroon, but it was immediately transformed into what we call a Christian or given name. It was given to many children who were born that night. The name Obama was made equal to Christian names like Joseph, Peter, Paul, and others from the Bible, just because of you, Mr. President. All this excitement was because we thought Africa would be saved by its own son, the son of a father who abandoned his family in the blessed land, the USA, to come back and help build Africa. Mr. President, in the year 2000, most people who were against George W. Bush and the Republicans agreed that he lost his election against Al Gore. But that did not stop the USA from accepting the ruling of the Supreme Court. And no president of any country in the world, no leader, uttered a word because they respected the USA and its institutions. Yet today, in the Ivory Coast, most people who are against President Laurent Gbagbo have refused to recognize his victory over his opponent, Alassane Dramane Ouattara. And you, Mr. President, openly took sides. You spit in the face of a whole nation. You spit on a constitution put in place by hardworking, intelligent, and vibrant citizens. Mr. Obama, you once said you're opposed to wars that are ideologically driven and based on power and politics instead of reason. You regretted the fact that the USA is mired in a tragic and costly war that should never have been waged because you certainly value the lives of your soldiers. American parents, just like African parents, have the same love for their children. None of them want a war in their territory or senseless wars out of their territory that will take away the lives of their children, which they suffered to raise. You didn't think about this, Mr. Obama, because it was not a war fought on the American soil. It's easier to provoke war on some people's land. Difficult to do the same on your own land because you value your children and close ones. Mr. President, the consequence of your lack of foresight is that innocent children, just like your girls, pregnant women, and parents, have lost their lives. They're still dying today. The list of orphans has drastically increased, and many people, through their inhuman acts, have bestowed curses upon themselves. Just because you want somebody, Ouattara, to earn the title President of the Republic. When the same dispute election happened in the USA in 2000, nobody died, and we did not hear your voice calling on the Democrats to take guns and remove President Bush from the White House so that Al Gore would earn the title President of the USA. On the contrary, in your speech during the Take Back America conference on June 14, 2006, you qualified President Bush as a good man who loves his country and said his administration was full of smart folks. Your reaction in the Ivorian crisis makes us understand that President Gbagbo and his administration are completely the reverse of what you think of the Bushes. What an insult to Africans. Mr. President, I don't understand where you get the guts without an iota of respect to ask an elected president of a sovereign nation, older in age than you, who holds a PhD like you, to step down from power. You claim you're trying to promote democracy, but do you really think democracy, which basically means the well-being of the majority of people, is achieved through a change of presidents? Please, do not get me wrong. I'm not putting the entire blame on you. I blame the short-sighted Africans who rely on your words. Words that bring disunity and hatred to destroy their nations and kill their brothers and sisters. Today, you and your cohorts, the so-called international community, have connived to destroy a country that poor and miserable Africans have taken decades to build. I blame Africans who do not want to see that you were voted in by Americans and not by Africans. I blame Africans who think that Barack Obama is acting in the best interest of Africa. Before I end my appeal, I want to let you know that some Africans have started wondering if the Barack Obama of today is the same Barack Obama they were anxious to see as the boss of the White House. In reference to the attack on Libya and the violence in Ivory Coast, one of my journalist Facebook friends made this statement that I translate literally from French. I have withdrawn my support for Barack Obama, who's working hand in glove with a nation like France that has always been working to destroy and destabilize Africa. Fighting for better governments is not a bad idea. It becomes bad when we are when we use unconstitutional and unconventional means to fight for good governments. Encouraging a rebellion, for instance, a heavily armed rebellion to take over a government. So please, Mr. President, Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Libya, Kenya, Nigeria, Ghana, and many others are blessed with intellectuals, hardworking citizens, and children who do not want to die because of a war driven by greed and who have the same love for their countries that Americans have for the USA. We have our own cultures, customs, and traditions that do not need missiles and bullets to solve our misunderstandings. Please listen to the clarion call of Africans around the world and respect our institutions just like we respect yours. In God, we Africans too trust. Awafong Julius Tenang wrote that letter, and we're proud to be the first to publicize it. And we hope you'll be seeing it in other places. Mike?
Chuck, now we've got a scheduled guest is Bob Truskowski from Texas. He is a Bigfoot researcher. He has his website is Sasquatch Sounds. And I hear from Len that Bob is not on the phone. So what I would like to do just quickly, briefly here is to I talked about Bigfoot in my opening, and I'm just going to go on for just a little bit here, a few minutes, but it's not that I think Bigfoot is as important as 9/11 or as important as any of the JFK or RFK or World News Today. It's just that I think it's just so interesting is all, I guess. It's just, I didn't always believe in it. I just think that, there's been so many sightings, and there's just so much evidence, and there are many people who will say that they've seen one face to face. And to me, it's just incredibly interesting. As I drove to the ball game today down to Minneapolis, it's about a 2-hour drive, and I was listening to my earphones, my tapes I had made last weekend in the woods out in the state park near Cloquet, where we live, and I always listen for, I don't know, I hear things, and And it's kind of funny to hear yourself say that that you listen to tapes of Bigfoot, but I really believe and it's true. And I think I guess it's the reason I harp on it so much is I think it's just a good metaphor for the United States and what the idea we're trying to get across is that in my mind, Bigfoot is real and we don't think it is, but we think of all these other things about America. Oh, you know, the different conceptions of history, and they're locked and loaded as being true. And actually, I think that they're not. I think that we have a misconception of history. And I just think it's important to, I don't know, to remain curious, to look around, and to not accept. I guess to not accept what's in the sophomore history text about what is true, what is right, what is really out there. I think it's important to always question authority, question what people say is true, and to keep your eyes open and your head on a swivel, and just keep looking around. And that's kind of why I keep talking about Bigfoot, and I just think that. That it's very interesting. I can talk a little more about Bigfoot if I'll wait for Chuck to get there. Chuck, if you do get there, just jump on in.
Yeah.
I've heard some howls and some screams and in the woods and on my tapes. And if you ever go into walk in the woods, I got a message from somebody from New Jersey, and they had said that they had responded to my picture. About the different stick formations in Texas, and they said that they see those in New Jersey too, and they thought it was put there by homeless people. And so, you know, if you see, let's see, if you see stick formations, they're kind of a teepee formation. You know, of course, anything is true. You can't say it's Bigfoot, but you know, you just keep your mind open to the different possibilities. And there's also these different, when I walk through the woods, I try not to take the path. I try and walk, I walk around the sign that says stay on the path. And then if you go in and you see these X formations or you see limbs that are kind of out of place, you kind of wonder what might have put those there. The other weekend I found just these incredible, huts. They were built kind of a remote area of the woods, and they were built on a V, and it was long enough for something to be in there. And I went back there a few days later because I had put a tape recorder there to retrieve the tape recorder, and I just kind of looked around and I saw there's another one and there's another one, and I finally found six of these. And they were kind of in a circle. And, you know, to me, I think that's just so interesting to think of what could have put those there. Of course, you know, you think it could have, my wife thought it was probably a wildlife photographer or something. Or it could have been a Boy Scout troop. And then I went on the internet and I saw that other people had pictures of similar structures they found in the woods. And, you know, so then maybe the possibility exists that it's more than a Boy Scout troop making huts out of sticks in the woods. And, you know, there's different theories about Bigfoot. Some think it's an ape. Some think that it's a form of human. You know, if they do exist, they're just incredibly smart. They're able to just think that they've been able to elude our capture for one thing, but even to elude us knowing that they even exist for how many years. And I don't know, if you go out in the woods, just if you hear some wood knocking, maybe it's me or maybe it's Bigfoot. People are writing in and say they want to hear about Bigfoot. Okay. Well, I actually think I came face to face with a Bigfoot in Spearfish Canyon back in the early 1980s, and I wasn't going to really mention this, but I had just, well, I wasn't too long out of the seminary, And a lot of times I don't do it much anymore, but I would go away to pray. So I went up to the mountain. There was a hill across from where we were staying. I went across the hill in the morning and walked up the very steep mountain. And I went to the top and I did my thing and I walked down and when I came back down, I think I came face to face with something. And it scared the holy crap out of me. And I remember running down the hill, not running, but as fast as I could, grabbing the different trees to go down. And I actually forgot about it for a long time. And I think it was just a few years ago that I finally remembered it, and I actually tried to go to a hypnotist and try and remember it, but I could not. So I work on it a little bit every day to try and remember my experience with Bigfoot or to remember what that was. But that's enough about Bigfoot. Chuck, what do we have next?
Well, new from your Democratic Party national headquarters, this country needs change. Poverty and unemployment are at an all-time high. More Americans than ever are in prison. Many Americans cannot afford adequate health care. It's not there's not enough wealth in this country. It's just that it's in the wrong hands. Who will light the fire for the new American Revolution? What Bastille will we storm? Who will light themselves on fire? What new giant rallies will be held for workers' rights? Where should we meet? On the docks? In the labor hall? At Marion Federal Prison? Dick Cheney's house? George Bush's house? Oh, no. Don't be ridiculous. We're the Democratic Party.
Now available online. Everything I learned in kindergarten is all I ever learned. It's new in a 9-disc package. We guarantee you will learn how to speak American. At the end of the day, stay on the same page, take it to the next level, keep it real, be awesome, and give 110%. Be on time, work hard, work 9 jobs, keep your head down, keep your mouth shut, stand for the anthem and the flag, watch the game in the living room after the big meal, keep your mouth shut and about anything that matters. But if you order today, a bonus package is available online from How to Become a Human Being. You will learn such useful phrases as stick it up your ass, eat me, I quit. Also including additional lessons such as football is so stupid, wrestling is so stupid, NASCAR is so stupid, and more bonus coverage, golf is really stupid. Order now. This PSA is from the county commissioners. Your county fair board is now looking for volunteers for the water board tank to be used this year as a fundraiser for Head Start, health care, bridge repair, pothole filling, teacher salaries, and the food shelf. Members of the National Guard, VFW, Police Department, Sheriff's Department, Republican and Democratic parties are encouraged to pop in and sign up. And this just in, this text message from the rest of the world to America, your blinker is on.
Tonight's special guest interview is with Anthony Rayson. Here in South Florida, when we think of DePaul University, we think of a great basketball player named Dwayne Wade. We love him. We're hoping he'll lead us to another NBA championship like he did a few years back with a different supporting cast. But there's another side of DePaul University. It's a highly respected center of learning where the focus is actually on teaching. Tonight's guest, Anthony Rayson, is not a professor at DePaul, nor is he a student there. Actually, he collects tolls on Interstate 80 near Chicago. He's been doing that for 36 years. But there is a connection to DePaul. Here it is. The Anthony Rayson Zine Collection is indexed and cataloged at DePaul University. You can find it on their website. That's quite a feather for Anthony to put in his cap. Anthony Rayson is a longtime grassroots organizer and educator, self-described Haymarket anarchist. He writes for, edits, publishes, and distributes hundreds of zines through his distro, the South Chicago ABC Zine Distro. These are made available and go mostly to indigent prisoners. He collaborates with dozens of prisoner artists and writers whose work permeates his Each One Teach One free school project. He's a prison abolitionist, working to help empower prisoners and others with the brutal truth. Malcolm X once said, America means prison. Anthony.
Hello.
Are you with us?
Indeed I am. Thank you.
Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Well, thank you.
Anthony, you're an interesting contradiction in terms. You've said on the one hand, you're Joe Normal with a typical suburban lifestyle. Without missing a beat, you're an anarchist activist. This juxtaposition is unusual, unique. How do these different lives coexist in one person?
Well, I'm 57 years old, so I came of age in the 60s, and I was involved in radical politics in high school against the Vietnam War and beyond that. But from the time I was about 25 till about 40, I sort of lost touch with the activist world. It collapsed after the end of the Vietnam War and the end of the draft. So,
well, yeah, we thought we won, you know.
Yeah, well.
Little did we
unfortunately,
know.
Unfortunately, everything turned to hell. It went to disco, and, it's just alienating. And so I got a job, and like everybody else, tried to scrape my way by and try to fashion a life for myself and find a partner and a wife and have children and all that. But it wasn't really till I hit 40 that I came to the realization that I was a serious anarchist. Those were my politics. And from then on, I've been, hellbound for leather, advocating what I believe in. And so really, I'm sort of a tale of two cities, time frames. But since the 90s, the mid-90s, I've really been extremely active doing all. And then I crafted this whole project that has taken a life of its own now and been very fulfilling and educational for me, too. And basically, this has been my kind of lifelong goal is to write and to be a thinker and to collaborate with fellow thinkers and writers and look for the most profound and well-written material and be a part of it. So that's what I decided to do, and I realized that the best way to go about it is to forge ahead and learn as I go on how the best way to do it and find mentors as I go along and develop what I'm doing now. So it's been...
Anthony,
so far, that's for sure.
I'm 2 years older than you are, so we grew up in pretty much the same sort of times, and I've really gone through a lot of the same stages you have. My politics have always tended towards anarchy as well. Maybe not in so many words, but pretty much the same thoughts. I thought in the 60s we really had something going, and we lost it. So I'm really glad to hear you taking this active role, and it's taken me a little longer to get back into it, but, this radio show is a start, right?
Yeah, definitely. we definitely need that kind of consciousness to sweep this country once again in a profound and effective way, and people are confused and brainwashed and disheartened and alienated way worse than ever nowadays. But look at the Middle East. You can see that such a thing that you wouldn't even think about a few months ago was sweeping that whole region. So it's certainly possible, even here in the brain dead America. Our job is to work with the oppressed to realize what is really going on and to connect with those people in a language that they understand, direct, plain English. And that's what why we call it brutal truth, or each one teach one. We get to the nuts and bolts of what the oppression here in this country is really all about, but through the words of the oppressed themselves. Let's not forget, prisoners are legally, by the 13th Amendment, still legal slaves in this country, and they're treated that way. And they're even challenging that slavery all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. They'll cite the 13th Amendment and say, no, the states are allowed to treat these people as human slaves. So this is what we have in this country. And for my money, the prisons are the ground zero here in the struggle here at home. Because the treatment that those people are, that's where Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, that's how they operate here in this country. That's where they brought those skills to Iraq and Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
From the U.S. prisons. Those were the people running those prisons in Iraq. Before that, they were running prisons in Pennsylvania. So we got to realize what we're up against. And who better to know than the oppressed themselves? Like years ago, Paulo Freire wrote a brilliant book in the 60s, late 60s, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And I'll read a couple sentences about it. Says, in order for the oppressed to be able to wage the struggle for their liberation, they must perceive the reality of oppression not as a closed world from which there is no exit, but as a limiting situation which they can transform. And for us, solidarity requires that one enter into the situation of those with whom one is in solidarity with. True solidarity with the oppressed means fighting at their side to transform the objective reality which has made them these beings for another. All too often, activists in this country talk above or talk to each other or talk to the police. They don't act and talk and go shoulder to shoulder with the oppressed. And that's insane.
Well,
the only way you're going to get people that are going to want to really transform this world, and those are the oppressed themselves, they're the only ones capable of doing anything, is to work directly with them as a brother, not as someone talking down on them, but one of them. And I'm very proud and happy to know that the prisoners have accepted me as their comrade, so I must be doing something right.
Well, that's good. Do you think that in order to really be one of them, you have to go and get yourself locked up?
No, you don't. And I don't. Like
good.
I say, I'm Joe Normal. I have a job, I have a wife, I have two sons. I am basically a goody two-shoes. I don't do anything normal other than have a free-thinking mind. But I certainly could connect with prisoners. Basically, it's through the mail, through writing handwritten letters, publishing and going editing their work. Occasionally, I'll visit a prisoner, but, it's mind-to-mind. It doesn't have to be, physical contact. We don't have to go run around and do the same stupid thing. I mean, criminal activity, I can't stand criminal activity, and that's why I can't stand the government so much, because that's all it is, a huge organized crime. Yeah, a lot of people did stupid things, and some of them are in prison for it. A lot of other ones are in prison for doing things that are, legal in other states and other countries that aren't really crimes, all kinds of things. It's not really about punishing criminals.
If you set out to lock up a certain percentage of your population, all you have to do is come up with some silly laws and plant some evidence for what people just normally do. And voila, there they are. They're all in prison.
Yeah, with a million laws, I mean, everyone breaks hundreds of laws every day. They could be thrown in jail for life and just living their normal day. So it's all very subjective. There's another terrific new book out, you probably heard of it, called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, by Michelle Alexander. And she was working with one of the Supreme Court members. Her husband is a prosecutor. Mm. Anyway, a quick note, what she says in her book, under the terms of our country's founding document, with the Constitution, slaves were defined as three-fifths of a man, not a real whole human being. This is the document that supposedly we think is like a God document. Upon this racist fiction rests the entire structure of American democracy. It's page 21. Here's another little quote. Although this new system of racialized social control purports to be colorblind, it creates and maintains racial hierarchy much as earlier systems of control did. Like Jim Crow and slavery, mass incarceration operates as a tightly networked system of laws, policies, customs, and institutions that operate collectively to ensure the subordinate status of a group defined largely by race. And I would also add class, of course, because there's a huge number of Latino and Native American prisoners, as well as whites, compared to what the incarceration rates are in Europe. It's off the charts what's going on in this country. It's a frenzy to incarcerate is what's going on here. And it's all called freedom and democracy. Unbelievable.
Well, of course, it's big business, too. And but that's
a huge business, and a lot of these
different story.
Prison companies are big shots on the stock market.
Sure. Sure. Well, I wish that we could go on with this, because I have a number of things I want to ask, but we have managed to run out of time.
Well, okay.
So
but
I hope maybe you'll visit with us again in a month or two. And
be glad to.
We
be
can talk
to.
About
and anybody
some
can
things.
Write to me and get a catalog or get a you know, sample of zines. They can write to me, South Chicago ABC Zine Distro, P.O. Box 721, Homewood, Illinois, 60430.
Great. Thank you. And I believe that people can get quite a bit of information on you and the cause of prisoners by Googling your name.
Oh, yeah. I'm not trying to hide from anybody. I'm just trying to tell the truth and trying to empower people and educate people and be educated myself.
All right. Well, thank you for being with us, and we will have you again.
Terrific. All you right? guys are doing a good thing. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. The local newspaper editor is already fighting the rumor of the proposed construction of a new prison near town. His father was also a newspaper man. He despises the term embedded, and he thinks Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather, and Peter Jennings, probably Walter Cronkite as well, were all CIA. It Begins in the Heart was one of the editor's most recent editorials about the need for a new American revolution. He had said that if there were to be a revolution in America, it would come from the center, from the heart, the land, the heartland. It would be something to turn the thousands of church buildings into more than social halls. And it would happen here, because here some folks have it within themselves to know right from wrong. Otherwise, what was he doing here? You can't go about your delightful day letting other people scrounge in the dirt for scraps from your table and then act all excited and surprised when they try to snatch a sliver of pie from your kitchen window. That's what he had said in his editorial. He hopes his writing would get him out of Mount Liberty someday. Somehow an editor in Sioux Falls or Worthington or Fremont might invite him to a real newsroom. Maybe that boss would let him do his job, the job of any good newspaper reporter confronted with small-town hysteria over some stupid thing. He would face it down with his Macintosh, like a sheriff in the street telling the lynch mob, "That'll be far enough, boys."
Because he's the editor-in-chief. Every goddamn morning, the grass fire of the day's worries surrounds Jackson Cornwall III, threatening to devour him as he shoves through the Wednesday Miracle glass front door. Actually, he wanted to write, not edit. This was the job offered, and they need the money. The radio blared from the empty desk of the sports reporter. "Hello, Mount Liberty. This is KWML on your AM dial, bringing you the hits of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and your work week weather forecast." "What have you got for today?" Cornwall asked Kurt, one of his two reporters. "There's a supervisor's meeting, the pets parade at the nursing home. Somebody said something to Tori's cousin about a fire somewhere last night. Paula in? Cornwall asked. Haven't seen her yet. I'm going next door. We'll have a meeting when I get back, said Cornwall. Jackson wants Kurt's job to just be a reporter. Everyone liked the stories that Jackson wrote when he got the time. They told him so. He wrote about school boards and war heroes and flower gardens and parades. But what he really wanted were murders and robberies with strings of guts caked to the wallpaper. At the big paper, he'd shine. He'd write about important things. Not like the story yesterday about how the wheelchair club petitioned the city council to put in ramp curb downtown. He needs to be a hero. He fears he's not a good enough person to just be normal. He doubts they'd let him be a hero in Mount Liberty. What is there to be a hero about around here? If he had a chance, he could be super writer. To shove through the door just before deadline, punch out literature about the things he discovered that day. He would hang a cigarette out his mouth. Jackson had read that Jimmy Breslin did it that way in New York. Jackson wants to be able to write about the castaways, the forgotten ones around town, the way Breslin wrote about murder victims and the regular guys who stumbled into the path of the oncoming establishment. To the rescue comes the writer with a telling detail about a lucky strike ash about to fall just as the rich guy is turned back. Once, Jackson turned out a good column about the grocery store checkout crew. How even though only in high school, they took their time to talk to the old ladies when they pushed their carts to their cars. How the old people liked that. But there'd been no guns. Jackson believes in Mount Liberty because he walks past the Crispy Cafe each morning on his way to the office, then comes back as soon as he can to sit and relax and have his coffee. He knows there's a certain spark in the cafe, beginning with the man hunched over the griddle, the born-again owner wearing the white stained T-shirt with the inscription, "The cook is on fire." Jackson looks inside the front window past the red checkered curtains and the stenciled inscription in the high school sports poster. He sees Mayberry, Metzger's Field, and Hooterville. He sees men drinking coffee from thick snow-white cups with hands stained with real dirt that will never come off. He sees grandmas and pop grandpas holding on to each other over the table, as if clinging to both sides of a raft in the middle of the sea. He sees high school boys and girls at the counter drinking pop that they don't even taste because they're so excited to be talking about whatever. That will never, ever taste as sweet as right now, this moment. Now, no, it's gone. Save it, save it, save it. It's gone. He sees the dawn sheep judging at the county fair and the winter's morning sunlight on the water tower and Jesus. The bell atop the front door jingled like Rudolph as Jackson walked in. Nine round metal stools at the counter face a Wells Blue Bunny calendar hanging from three swatches of duct tape on a 10-foot mirror. The Crispy opens at 5 a.m. Through the day, groups gather in the booths and around the 10 tables, sipping coffee and rebuking anything they've heard on the radio or in the daily paper. The 535 construction workers crouch silently in the middle of the room, clutching life jacket mugs to keep them out of the day's chill for two more minutes. The mid-morning business crowd displays themselves in the front two booths. Later, the mid-afternoon retired men pull two tables together at the south end of the counter on a glass case filled with Baby Ruth bars. There's red and yellow suckers there, too, and year-old junior mints. An open matchbox of mint toothpicks cozies up next to the register, like an old hound. Waitress Chandra Schumann wears her hair short. Used to be in a beehive. Before that, a bun. This year, she had to shop trim it, get that hair off her neck for the summer. The uniform she has on has been left in the wash with a red towel. She's just going to have to wear it now. With the grace of a figure skater, she steps around canes, crackers, and pacifiers, sliding over the white and black tile between her table. She works Monday through Saturday, 5 to 2. The owner and his wife cook breakfast, lunch, and supper, and help with the tables and register. Each summer, a different class holds its reunion in the Crispy, which used to be the carousel, till it burned. The born-again cook bought it from his old boss and held a contest to rename it. He let everyone vote between Crispy and Phoenix. During the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, the place was the high school hangout, before McDonald's, Dairy Queen, and Taco John's sprang up along the highway. Chandra rushes across a floor gouged with black boot scuff marks. Maybe some still there from 1932 when the farmers crowded inside before they stormed the Ace County Courthouse to stop the forced sale of Garner Warner's farm. Out in the grove behind the old Lutheran cemetery, they had the noose pulled tight around the neck of the grizzled judge who would not agree to stop foreclosing on farms. Then the National Guard arrived with bayonets drawn. Today, Jackson Cromwell, the editor, needs to make a list of stories for this week's issue. Remember to go to the manager's meeting at noon. Make it to one of his daughter's track meets before the season ends. He sat down in his customary front window booth, prepared for the solitary comfort of eating. Food could not be enjoyed any other way. Taped to his office desk, he kept a permanent to-do list. Cafe, meditate, run. He didn't actually meditate or run, but he kept the pressure on. Someday he might. Jackson looks out the window to think, nods and waves to the state farm agent because he has to. Looks back down at his notes. Having lived in this area most of his life, Jackson knows that all around here for miles, handmade signs and boards rented from U-Haul dot the landscape. Are you a slave to alcohol? If your Bible's in good shape, you probably aren't. God bless America, we support our troops. He's also aware that pockets of cynical populists also inhabit the backcountry. If he never gets the big paper, maybe they'll save him. Pull his spirit out of the blue haze of the television glow into the light. They don't put messages on their lawns. They send joke suggestions to Garrison Keillor. Review new fiction to the New Yorker. Their great-grandfathers loved Eugene Debs and Robert La Follette and learned to despise Woodrow Wilson. Their great-grandmothers admired Dorothy Day and Jeanette Rankin. They learned at their knees about a day when life was hands-on, when people read and cared about what was happening, followed the deeds of national leaders as if they were sitting at the weekly sales barn auction, or reading the minutes of the local school board meeting or the co-op association. They go to church meetings and school plays, realizing they enter and exit always slightly out of step with their neighbors. At election time, they enter the middle school gym with seed corn caps in hand, write in their wildest hopes, and go home to milk, leaving the radio on into the night. They mow their lawns, scoop their walks, looking up every now and then at the sound of the city snowplow scraping and listening for the revolution.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the water quality inspectors are about average.
That's another show. We'd like to thank again the Rock Creek Free Press for sponsoring our show. And we hope you'll visit the show's website, theshow.newamericandream.info. And since you're here, be sure to stay tuned for Black Op Radio coming up next. Stop back again next week. Same time, same place. Thank you, and good night, Mike.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Carl Rove, and good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Before I go, I got to tell you about the world that I see. And it's sad sometimes. You ever realize that we live in a world where good men are murdered, mediocre hacks thrive? You ever notice that? John Kennedy murdered. Gandhi murdered. Martin Luther King murdered. Jesus murdered. Reagan wounded. Cancer 8 times. Now that fucker still walks, doesn't he? That guy is Jason, man. You can take off that hockey mask just once. You're going to find, well, I'm back. People love him. Love him. Every fact points that he's a liar, corporate puppet, devil, cock-sucking fascist. Every fact points to that. Not one fact to the opposite. But what happens?
We love you, Ronnie. 4 more years. 4 more years.
Let's put him on Mount Rushmore. Let's put him under Mount Rushmore. They love him. How far up your ass does this guy's dick have to be before you realize he's fucking you, man? People are just, I like him. I don't know what it is. He looks good on TV. He brought back patriotism. God damn it, he's a good American. Hold it, something's slapping my ass. Oh my God, he's fucking us! Well, Nancy and I feel that. Man, you might know, as John Wayne once told me that. Man, you might remember as Jimmy Stewart. Well, shut the fuck up. You answer a question like a man, you fucking lying, bee-actor, dickweed, Mr. President, sir. And all due respect.
Rock Creek gently flows through the parkland of Washington, D.C., until it meets the mighty Potomac River in the heart of the federal city. On the other hand, Rock Creek Free Press is a fiercely independent newspaper that's not afraid to print the truth. We print the stories that others won't touch. The 9/11 cover-up, media propaganda, government corruption, state terrorism, and violations of our constitutional rights. The Creek is a completely reader-supported publication. We accept no corporate advertising, no corporate influence. For a free, no-obligation issue of The Creek, just go to rockcreekfreepress.com. If you want copies for your local 9/11 truth group, send your request to editor@rockcreekfreepress.com. Rock Creek Free Press, not afraid to print the truth.
And now, back to the show with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelacek.